Welcome to the first of the water sessions. Glad you all can make it at 3 o'clock. I don't know if any of you have been at work camp today, but I figured there wouldn't be a lot of those after long days of work. But my name is Greg McLaughlin, and I'm going to be giving 4 sessions this week on various aspects of water. My background is I grew up in Missouri and went to school in Colorado and got a biology degree and whatnot, and I spent quite a bit of my career working in natural resource issues, and been overseas doing that, and I'm very interested in natural resources issues as a cultural process and a local political process, and especially in terms of how people in communities work out shared resources. And you know, my graduate research was on the big conflicts between the ranchers and the wolves and the grizzly bears out in Yellowstone. And there's a lot of values at play. There's a lot of conflict, and you know, I got a lot of experience working through that. And so now I work for an outfit called Washington Water Trust, and basically my job is to work between the big hydropower funding sources and the farmers and the tribes and the local governments in eastern Washington to get everybody to agree about how to use water. So you think that conflicts between ranchers and wolves is bad. You should see what we get to deal with water. So it's an interesting process, just a challenge, a challenge people as resource managers to really deal with some complicated issues of how do people share a resource, how do people make it work out when there's different values at play. So I'm going to, today I'm going to just do some introduction stuff on water. We're just going to have fun today, really. And we're not going to have fun the rest of the day. Tomorrow I'm going to talk about some of the conflicts, and not just here, but in many other places, and talk about some really interesting history of some time I spent down in southern Colorado with some communities that used to be part of Mexico, and some conflicts. If anybody's ever read a book called The Milagro Beanfield War, it's the same community, but I actually had a chance to go and work and live in that community. And there are some interesting issues around water there, but obviously in my today's day and age, I work with some of that too. Then the third session is called How the West is Being Won for Water. And basically what a lot of people are learning is how to turn this, story of conflict into a story of cooperation, and how there really are some interesting models and stories developing for how you can have enough water for farms and fish and tribes and everybody. But it's about how do we work together, how do we treat our fellow person, how do we respect each other's values. There's some very spiritual ideas related to that I think are kind of interesting. And then the last is to talk about the future with climate change, with population growth. What does that mean for water? What does that mean for people? What does that mean for people being able to persist on this planet and eat and have a place to live, which we'll kind of talk about that. But today, basically, we're going to have fun, and I know this is an afternoon class, so what I want us to start by doing is there's a whole bunch of dry erase markers here, and I want everybody to get up, stand up. So we'll start by standing up. That's the first thing. Just pretend like you're singing a hymn or something. Right now, I just want you to kind of form a line like you do at communion, but instead of, drinking wine and eating bread, I want you to just grab a marker and just write a word or a phrase of what water is to you. The first word that comes to your head. There's no wrong answers. And there's lots of markers, so feel free to, crowd around a little bit. If you want to, you can either write the same word over, that's fine. I was at a thing to, earlier today, I said the same thing somebody else did, but it's just because I liked what they said, so it's, you know. Come on in. You are welcome.
Yeah.
Okay, so as people are writing down, feel free to come in and have a seat, anybody. So it's always interesting when you're talking about a subject to kind of get an idea of what, where people approach it and what kinds of things are there with that. Another question I have is how many people here are from, a state where there's an arid place, probably east of the, okay. So what states are those?
You can just, South Dakota.
Minnesota.
Okay. Nebraska. Okay, yeah, so, and then who's from a wet state? All right.
Minnesota's wet.
That's all right. Okay. So this is one of the things we'll talk about this week. It's really interesting with the way water laws work because you really kind of, from Nebraska, Kansas, east, water law is totally different than what it's like out here in the west. The whole fundamental premise around water is based on the ideas of, almost like overabundance or the quality of the water, whereas out here it's more based, on how do you allocate it. So what we're going to do is right now we're going to play games. And I need a couple volunteers, and it has to be somebody who likes M&Ms. So who wants to volunteer who likes M&Ms? There's one volunteer. So you want to volunteer too? Okay, why don't you guys come on up here? Okay, I'm gonna need you guys' help. You guys are my water managers, all right? And are you more of an M&Ms person or a Skittles person?
Skittles.
What about you?
Skittles
too. Okay, all right. Well, I can figure out something to do. All right. Here's your bucket. Okay. All right, so every time you put water in there, you fill up one of these containers and put a container of water in there. I'm going to put a Skittle in your bucket. Okay, you ready? Go.
There's no water.
Well, where does water come from?
The tap.
It comes from the tap?
It comes from rivers and oceans.
It comes from both?
It comes from God.
Well, it looks like we need some water, don't we? Where are we going to get the water?
From the tap.
From the tap? Yeah, that's probably where we have to get it. But does the water come from the tap?
No, it comes from the... Yes, no. Maybe so. I'm not sure.
No. Well, we better go find some water. So can you guys work together and find some water?
Yeah.
Okay. I think you might be able to find some. So one of the things that I want to talk about is what, water means to me and what water means to us for the sake of this. And for today, what I want to think about is two things. That's good for now. I'm going to reveal the other one later once they start deciding they want more Skittles. Precious and finite. So even though we might live in a place where water is abundant, we were just talking earlier about how much work and energy it takes to transport water from one place to another. I'm sure who here knows stories of places that aren't in the United States, and maybe there are, what do people have to do with water? Does it come out of the tap? What's that?
Carry it in buckets.
Buckets.
From the well, yeah.
From the well. I mean, it used to be like that here, too. I don't know if anybody ever, you know, grew up at a time where, you know, you knew what the term get water meant. You know, has anybody ever had to go get water?
In state park camping about 50 years ago.
Oh, yeah, during camping. You appreciate it when you go camping, you know. Did you guys find some water?
Yes, we found water.
All right. Okay, well, we'll continue this in a second.
Found it.
All right, so you guys ready to go?
Yeah.
We'll go for it. I'm just going to start putting Skittles in. All right. So there's one for him. You might want to participate, too. Oh, you just did one. All right. Oh, there's another one. There's one. Okay. Okay. You guys got a lot of water there. So you're having to work for this water a little bit, aren't you? Do you think you're gonna get very many Skittles?
No.
Why? Why aren't you gonna get that many Skittles?
Because there's not very much water.
Because the Skittles aren't as big as the cups.
Well, would you rather have a Skittle or a cup of water?
A cup of water.
You'd rather have a cup of water than a Skittle?
Yeah, me too.
You guys should drink more water. All right. You're doing pretty well. So what do you think is going to happen when you guys run out of water?
Well, then we'll stop getting Skittles.
You'll stop getting Skittles. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
It's a bad thing.
Yeah. All right. You guys are doing a great job. All right, well.
That's about the equivalent of that, so.
Okay, good job, guys. So you got some Skittles. Now, unfortunately, I have some bad news. There's been a pollution outbreak, and the water over there is polluted, so we can't get any more. But there is a way for you guys to get Skittles. More Skittles, because you have to get Skittles by pouring water from there into there. Can you guys figure out how to get more Skittles?
Pour that water into there.
These guys are so smart. That's why I wanted kids here, because you guys would have figured that out. That's right. Water is renewable. So if you're out in nature...
Four.
And the water goes down. The water comes down into the stream, and it goes down into the river. What happens when waters are in the lakes and the rivers? What's the next thing that happens?
They go into the ocean.
In the ocean, and it just stays there?
Oh, wait, no. They evaporate, and then they go back into the lakes and the rivers.
That's right. So what you guys are doing is you're making the water evaporate back up into our white cloud here.
Okay.
And you're refilling the water supply. So the nice thing about water is it's, at any one time, there's a finite amount of water. It's very precious because we got to get it to where we are. But it's renewable. It's always going to come back. And water is so forgiving that way because it's always going to come back. But at any one time, we have to really think about how much we have. And that's why I talk about water being karmic. Water is really operates on karma. If we treat it well, if we don't pollute it, if we learn how to manage it as a resource, it gives back. If we don't manage it well as a resource, it's unforgiving and it punishes us. In places, even where there's an abundance of water, how do you manage those water? Maybe it's because, good job guys, you can take those back and then you can give these to somebody that you like, since you guys don't like M&Ms. What they kind of learned with this process here was that there's a lot of these decisions that go into how we manage water. And that's kind of really what I want to talk about this week, is how do we work together in these communities and in places, to really take care of the shared resource. And there's something else I want to do for this week, because obviously abundance of, you know, the abundance of life and the whole concept of water as a metaphor, as a spiritual idea, is a big part of this week. And there's some spiritual connections with water that I think other people are going to make in their sessions and have made in their sessions. But a lot of times, just like water here in the West, we think about it in terms of scarcity, you know, and like a lot of things, we try, whenever something starts to feel scarce, our natural response is to hoard it and to protect ourselves, to keep other people from getting it. And, you know, I mean, raise your hand if you've heard some parable in the Bible about what happens when you try to hoard things. You know, what's some examples of that?
In the Exodus story, the hoarding stinks.
Uh-huh.
Rocks.
Yeah.
The man who builds the bigger barns and then he dies and doesn't get to take any of his stuff with him.
He doesn't get to take any of it with him. Right. The rich man and Lazarus. Yeah. I remember growing up the Magic Penny song, you know, like, love is something, if you give it away, you end up having more. It's a spiritual idea of that's sort of throughout our spiritual discovery of how do we find that abundance of God? How do we experience the abundance of life around us? And there's all this stuff in the Bible about giving. And, you know, it's almost like it's against our human nature. There's a part of our human nature that all of us have times of being selfish. All of us have times of being worried or scared that somebody might come in and take something from us and that we won't be able to have the things we need. We won't have the money for retirement, or we won't have the water for our fields, or we won't have the ability to provide for our children or our grandchildren. And the natural inclination of us as humans is to pull in and to hoard. But here we're being called in so many ways to give. Well, is there a selfish reason for giving? I think that water offers us the selfish reason for giving. whereas this is how it can actually come back and be an important part of our lives and the lives of future generations. And that's going to be one of the things that we talk about this next week. So, you know, I'm not going to provide too much information. Can I have some volunteers again? Yeah, you guys want to come up? All right, you guys can come back up. There might not be as much candy. He's sharing that candy with you, isn't he? Are you sharing your candy? Okay, good. All right. So, one of the things I want to do is just make water come alive for you guys. So, can I get you to help me? I sure would like a glass of wine. Can you turn this water into wine?
No?
Well, give it a try. See what happens. Whoa! The other thing about water is it's very flexible. There's lots of things that you can do with water. How do you think that happened?
You put food colored water on the glass.
These kids are way too smart. And the other thing I want to do is make water come alive for you. So, hold this. You ready? All right. There we go.
That's not water.
I put powder in the bottom. It's not water. What is it?
It's vinegar.
That's right. But as a metaphor, the metaphor of the fountain, the metaphor of water coming to life, and they were supposed to get me a towel. I'm really sorry.
Mom, get some paper towels.
Do you get paper towels? I'm really sorry. I did order a towel. But just think you got candy, you know?
Instead of vinegar.
But I do want to make water come alive for us. And as we go through this week, we're going to be talking a lot about water and as a faith idea. And I also wanted to just understand the resource. You guys can go sit down if you want.
Okay.
She'll get you a towel. Thank you for playing along. Oh, good. Thanks.
what's on that spot.
Well, I'm just going to know that.
I just started again.
Yeah. I told him to do this, so I got permission ahead of time. So the other thing, I'm going to spend a little time just talking about actually this question of the tap and what's happening with water in this valley and at Holden Village and what's going on at the river here. But then I wanted to open it up for some discussion and just put some ideas out there for people about, how do you guys interact with water now? This question of, in what places is water scarce? What places is it abundant? And how are we managing this resource? But what's really interesting, if you go outside of Holden and you kind of look up and you see these valleys, you notice there's a very distinct shape to these valleys. They're kind of a U shape. And whenever you see these U-shaped valleys, that means there was glaciers. Glaciers make a U depression in the landscape. And so what's really visible here from a natural history perspective is this evidence of these glaciers just really filling this area. And this is just a classic example of a watershed that's been influenced by glaciers over time. Lake Chelan is the remnants of fairly recent glaciers. The other thing that's interesting, has anybody ever seen, just looked at that ridge where Cloudy Pass is up there? You go up probably, 9 or 10 miles up the trail that way. One of the things that's really interesting about Cloudy Pass is that you'll see clouds kind of billowing over and then they stop, And it's usually a lot clearer and sunnier over here than it is over there. Does anybody know why that happens?
It's a rain shadow.
What's a rain shadow, Paul?
Well, I think it's that the clouds go up to hit the peak, and then it takes a ways for them to come down again.
Right.
So it's that place on the other side of the mountain where the clouds are still ascending.
When these clouds move up, go higher up in the atmosphere and get colder, it squeezes all the water out. So you'll see this idea of rain shadows. You always wonder, why is eastern Washington, for example, so dry and scrubby? Well, there's this big curtain of the Sierra Nevadas that just push the clouds up and squeeze them out and wring them out. And then it just dries out. So like, for example, where I live in Ellensburg, we get about 8 to 12 inches of rain every year. And obviously Seattle is anybody here from Seattle or what? Yeah. You have so much rain that at this point you're probably sick of it. I know I was in Seattle. What's that?
It varies tremendously across the region.
Yeah.
From anywhere from about 20 inches up to 60 in the Puget Sound area.
Yeah, the Olympics get
in there. Too
bad. Well, I heard an interesting statistic about Seattle the other day. They only get about 37 inches of rain a year, which doesn't sound like that much.
That's what most of the East Coast cities get. Most of the East Coast cities get that amount of rain.
Oh, yeah. We got 9 inches in 3 days 2 weeks ago. But they just get it all the time.
Yeah, and that's just a climactic kind of consideration. And I think it's why in Washington is really very interesting because the water issues they even deal with just over the hill are so much different than the ones we deal with. Holden happens to be right at that interface. I mean, I'm not sure how much Holden gets a year. I didn't look it up, but it's a little bit higher up. So I'm guessing it's in the 18 to 20 inches of rain a year is what Holden gets. But what that means is that as you go further east from here, it becomes an issue of people really having to negotiate and navigate for water. I always said growing up in Missouri that if we wanted it to rain, we would just go to church and, pray and God would make it rain, But God doesn't like people in the West quite as much because that's not enough. They do it there.
And, you know, the church is-
Maybe it's because people don't go to church enough in the West. Yeah, that could be it. And so, but it, in some ways, that opportunity to manage and work on these water issues is a really important creative force. And there's a whole history here. When you think about history of people in this area, it really does come back to a story of water. Water, really in most places you see settlements right by rivers. The first documented human settlements are by rivers. If you look at, I was just looking at this History of Science book, and it really documents the Roman aqueducts, you know, back in the 200 or 300s BC. What's really funny is they said, well, these are the first aqueducts ever built. And they obviously haven't been to the Americas because there was aqueducts and acequias, diversion channels being used by the tribal people 5 or 10,000 years ago in some cases. So people have been figuring out how to interact with water in a way that helps them promote their civilization, and with mixed degrees of success. And if you look historically at the history of some of the peoples that have lived, the ones, whether it's water or it usually has to do with water because it has to do with food and famine, the ones who've maintained the resources well figure out a way to survive, and the ones that don't really subject themselves to these issues of famine and destruction. So there's a whole history in the United States of water as an economic good. And I think there's a lot of assumptions that we have about how we value water and what water means to us. So this is why I had us write down what water meant to us, what water means to each of you, because I think we all come to the table with a certain amount of value. And there's some themes here that I think that I was not surprised to see, and that, you know, the idea of water being renewing, life, refreshing. So all of these things, thirst quenching, health, so I think a lot of us understand that the life-giving qualities of water and how water does give life. There's, water as a substance from a scientific point of view is really connected and important to that H2O, and how it can take on different forms. It really is an amazing substance in that it allows life to exist. It allows us to have biochemical reactions in our bodies and allows life to continue to exist. But there's other stories of water. Water, definitely, like this idea of hard to control, whether it's flooding. Water being powerful, water being this force in the universe, water being abused. So I think that some of these ideas that you guys have put on about water reflect some of that value of, okay, this is really important to us. Now what? What are some things that we can do to help it continue to be valuable for us? And we'll talk a little bit about some of the history and how people locally in the West are dealing with some of these issues and why it's not as easy as that, because if you look at the allocation of water in some places, the ability to use it in a certain way, really some people are first in the drinking fountain, and the people that are behind them kind of have less opportunity to gain from it economically. So what do we do about that? So that's generally the overview for today on things like that. And what I wanted to talk about was, first of all, to kind of open it up to some discussion about what people see in the places you live as some of the key water issues. And then also some of the things you'd maybe like to learn more about this next week about water as well.
Well, back where some of us are from, east of the Mississippi, and that Great Lakes area, one of the controversies over the last couple of years and the government, or the governors of those particular Great Lakes states got together and said, we will not allow the sale of Great Lakes water. And apparently there was a plan to, I don't know, take water from the Great Lakes and bring it west. Is the resource that scarce, or are we just, or is the demand just that much too great for the population?
We certainly have had historically a bunch of people move west, you know, and move from places where water was plentiful, places where it's not. Are the folks from Tucson still here? Yeah. I mean, there's no water in Tucson. Where do you guys get your water from in Tucson?
Well, the Colorado River, I think, but a lot of it.
But the river doesn't run through Tucson.
Right, no. It's made a canal to bring it over to Phoenix and Tucson, and Las Vegas, and California.
How far away is the Colorado River from Tucson?
Is it a couple hundred miles?
At least.
So, does that begin to answer your question? So Tucson has a 200-mile canal.
I'm a little puzzled if water's that scarce, why do you see green yards?
Those are the Phoenix people.
Oh, those are the Phoenix people.
Not the Tucson people.
It's because the government subsidizes it, so it's cheap, and you can afford to do that, basically.
I know somebody who lives in that county, and the largest water feature in the county, what's the county Tucson's in?
Pima
County, is the effluent from the treatment plant in the city of Tucson. That's the largest water feature, flowing water feature in the whole area. And all that water, it's piped by canal from Colorado River, such as it is, you know, all the way through. And this is, you know, so this is some of these areas that are really starting to make some of these decisions about water. So
in terms of subsidy, and we're pretty careful as we water harvest throughout our plants, our garden, but we are under $200 a year we spend on water. And we live in the desert, so there's something wrong there.
Yeah.
Oh, you spend under $200 a year on water.
We spend about $800 in Seattle, where there's a lot of water.
So there's a complex story with that, because I think one of the stories that applies to Seattle and to some other cities is the water quality issue. You know, some of it has to do with just the cost of treating water and keeping it fresh. You know, think about, I think it's 5% of our global water resources are fresh water or less, and you know, not much of the water is at any one time is usable. And it's really expensive in some ways to get it in your faucet. You know, you have to go through all this treatment and things like that. That water quality, you know, the fact that that's, you know, the fact that the water is life, it's renewing, it's what we subsist off of. And then you kind of compare that to some of the behavior people have around water. It's, you know, whether it's, well, I sure don't want to wait for the household hazardous cleanup day. You know, I'm just going to pour the stuff down the drain. And then, it's really a shared resource. We all end up having to use it together. One of the interesting thing about water, and this is true anywhere, is that you can't actually own water in the United States. The only thing you can own is the right to use it. It's called a usufructuary right, legally. But what you really have, and I'm going to talk about this tomorrow because I got a hold of the Holden water right for the, and I'm going to actually put it up there and talk about their whole water right, see if they're in compliance, you know. it's really a right to use water in a very specific way. So interestingly, we're just borrowing it, you know. God owns the water. I mean, he was right. It does come, you know, it does kind of come from God.
In addition, it's the right to use it when it's available. And if it's not available, nobody has the right to use it.
If it's not, that's right. If it's available, you know, and for those of you who come from places where water is available, you know, you would know if it wasn't available. But there's places where it isn't, you know, where, okay, I'm deciding, it's okay, I got my farm here, you know, I don't know the water's going to be available every year, so instead of getting into the grapes or orchards where I have to be able to keep it watered every year, I'll just grow some hay and just impact some of the decisions people make. Another example, this is one I like, because I like to kind of present this water discussion outside of the realm of politics, because I think it can get politicized and become a, you know, because for example, when I do my work, I focus on getting water in stream for salmon, so it's really easy for that to become a liberal versus conservative, you know, progressive versus, you know, conservative discussion point, you know, but I like to talk about water in terms of economics, and that's another thing I want to focus on, valuing water. It's a really tricky thing to talk about, because as soon as you start talking about commodifying something like water, you know, there's some people who are like, well, you can't do that, you can't put a price tag on things like water. You know, the only thing is, it's, and I'm going to tell a story that illustrates that in a second, is that until we really understand the value of water, then we can't value it. And I think a lot of it is sort of, there's one thing I want to get across during this week, it's this, is when you value the sacred words of the fountain, scarcity becomes abundance. And what I mean is that, you know, one of the things we need to focus on with water is thinking about the tap, thinking about the fountain, thinking about the watershed, you know, thinking about the stream that we pull water from, the lake that's the reservoir for our town, the source, and really honoring that source and understanding that source is important. So the example I'm going to give is in my community, there was a lot of people that wanted to build these houses all over the place in the county. And they were able to do that under, and they were actually able to put a well in these, they call them exempt wells, and pull as much groundwater out as they wanted to, which is, you know, which is fine. And the county just sort of let them do that. But then they all of a sudden they had two problems. One is they let too many people do it in too many different places. So the people who own the water rights, the senior owners of the water rights, threatened to sue them because the water that they had a right to was getting what they call impaired or damaged by the other people that were putting these wells in. And the second problem they started having with that was that they started having to build all these fire control districts and roads and all these things out to all these different places. Well, the water thing came to a head because all of a sudden the county was in a situation where they couldn't approve a new business or a new development or a new anything because they had the county, like nobody in the county could get water. It was all over allocated and there was no way to get it back. So if the county wanted to approve some new business that would create 50 new jobs, then the water wasn't available for that. And so the county had made some decisions about just kind of letting people put up houses and things wherever they wanted to, but hadn't thought as much economically about it, ended up behind the eight ball in terms of the water, and we're in a position where a real economic opportunity to create jobs and to provide people with water, when those came up in those places, they couldn't do anything. And their hands were tied. So it really is something that's worthwhile thinking about. It's not, again, it's not really a political issue. It's more, there's a financial, there's an economic case to be made for managing water and how we allocate water in different places. So, but the cost of delivery and the social cost of getting water from one place to another is, you know, is something to think about.
Greg, I don't know if this fits at this point, but one of the things I see with water is just so much wastefulness. After a stint in Tanzania, we became really aware of that, where water was very scarce, and potable water was particularly scarce. We had to boil everything we drank. What do you know about community research and in how to help communities be more conscious of not wasting so much water. Our community has a lot of watering restrictions, for example, every other day, different sides of the street, not between noon and six.
Okay, in South Dakota?
But,
yeah.
But there's very little compliance. I mean, you see people watering all the time in mid-afternoon, in a full sun.
And it rained yesterday.
Yeah, so you see the sprinkler systems going during the day.
Well, I think that it comes down to valuing it and understand. I mean, I believe it becomes, it's an economic thing. So the whole thing of low flow toilets and fixing leaky faucets, I mean, that matters. But I'm not as concerned about that stuff because I just can do the math in my head. An acre of water will evaporate into the sky. And as soon as it evaporates, it goes to the next county. You know, as soon as that water evaporates, it goes to the skies over in the next county, whoever's downwind. An acre of grass in a season is going to evaporate about 2 or 3 acre feet of water. An acre foot of water is 300,000 gallons. So basically, 1 million gallons of water in 1 acre of grass gets evaporated every single year. So you think about 1 million gallons of water and compare that to, you know, a low flush toilet, and you really see the value of landscaping. We have a cultural value in our country of the lawn. You know, the lawn is so important to us. Not just the lawn, but the bluegrass lawn. You know, which is one of the most evaporative grasses out there. You know, you can use fescues, or you can use local grasses that give you a green lawn. You can even use ones that the kids can play on and use half the water. It's not a question of us, oh, my lifestyle or my culture is going to get destroyed because I have to switch from bluegrass to fescue. But if you think about what could happen, you know, if everybody did that, if everybody was more conscious of just about how they landscape, or xeriscaping would be great, you know, stuff you don't have to water at all. That really creates more opportunities for everybody in a place to use water, you know, the best way they can. So, yeah, the landscaping is a big one, though. Sorry, go ahead.
We came out of the Midwest, and we always had lawns, but now in Tucson, you don't have lawns at xeriscape. And so we started to think about that different. And I suppose grass is not a particularly efficient use of water. It's such a shallow plant. And like you say, so much is wasted. But we've chosen this cultural value consciously and unconsciously that makes us not only need green grass, but pour tons of fertilizer on it. And all of that stuff. And I just wonder, did we choose that, or was that imposed on us by various other people or corporations or something? I don't know. Because it seems like such an inefficient way to...
Just the whole, yeah. Like, why do we have this relationship with our lawn?
Why? Where did that come from?
I was going to suggest, I mean, when I visited England, I get the sense that this is an English import. Look at England, and the small, of course, their lawns are about, you know, 5 by 10 feet big, but it's meant to be ornamental kind of thing. But it makes sense there where they got this steady, you know, cold, drizzly rain, and it doesn't require fertilizer or water.
May I comment?
Oh, yeah.
Sorry. I mean, grass itself is actually meant to die, and it doesn't use water the rest of the year, okay? The fact you want it to be green is what's doing this. And grass has tremendously deep roots. And prairie grasses and stuff, you know, those...
Well, prairie does.
Well, there's lots of grasses. But if you try and keep them green, it also can encourage shallow
roots, too.
So it goes back... I'm not disagreeing with what you're saying, but it's just our encouragement in green. Grasses can be quite okay. It's a circumstance.
I'm going to try to suggest some books as things so as we go along that I thought have been interesting about water. One, which I think is a must read if you're interested in water in the West, is a book called Cadillac Desert. I don't know if anybody's read that before, but it's really interesting. It's about the big dams, Lake Powell, those things that were built a long time ago, and how water and power interact. It's really a fascinating story. But this is Desert Solitaire by Ed Abbey, if anybody's read this. We had this discussion earlier. He wasn't one of these people that got along with other people really well. But he had some interesting things to say about water. This is when he lived I think it was in Moab, in the not Canyonlands, but the one that's
Arches.
Yeah, he was a park ranger in Arches. And this is a discussion between him and somebody from Cleveland. This would be good country, a tourist says to me, if only you had some water. He's from Cleveland, Ohio. If we had water here, I reply, this country would not be what it is. It would be like Ohio, wet and humid and hydrological, all covered with cabbage farms and golf courses. Instead of this lovely barren desert, we would have only another blooming garden state, like New Jersey. You see what I mean? Well, if you had some more water, more people could live here. Yes, sir. And where then would people go when they wanted to see something besides people? I see what you mean. Still, I wouldn't want to live here. So dry and desolate. Nice pictures, but my God, I'm glad I don't have to live here. I'm glad too, sir. You wouldn't want to live here, and I wouldn't want to live in Cleveland. We're both satisfied with the arrangement as it is. Why change it? So I think there's a cultural, you know, understanding that people have with water, and I think that part of the answer to your question is actually that people, when they move from a wetter place to a drier place, kind of freak out. Because, it's just so scrubby here. You know, it's so dry. I'm going to die here if there's not something growing here. You know, you just feel thirsty looking at the landscape. You imagine yourself out there like, you know, like some old guy that's just bones, you know, like this leathery face, like crawling through the desert, you know, just because, you know, that's water really is a part of us. So that cultural relationship, I think, has a lot to do with migration, you know, from places where people are, it's what you're used to. You know, Holden's a great example. We all have to kind of come to Holden and, you know, jettison what we're used to and get used to something else. And it's not like it's a bad thing. I mean, you know, I haven't done a Twitter update for 3 days. Maybe that's not the end of the world.
What I think is most interesting is that most people nowadays don't even want to mow their lawns, but yet they want to keep them green.
Oh, really?
I mean, a lot of people, you know, object to how much time they have to spend when they have to mow them. And you have to do that when you water and fertilize.
Yeah, does anyone know how much it costs to get your lawn mowed now?
I do it myself.
Yeah. Like if you're a
hired... I know, but it's increasing, because I live in Minnesota, and it's increasing the number of lawn services that I see in our neighborhood.
Oh, yeah, I used to mow lawns for like $5 or something when I was a kid.
No, I'm sure it's more than 20.
Yeah, I think it's like 25 or 30.
Yeah.
I'm like, wow, I missed the boat. You know,
and I live in a town of 18,000, which I don't know if you think of that as a small town or big town, but I mean, it's not a big, huge city. But, and so the fact that there's just, you know, that there's still that sense of having these lawn services grow up.
Yeah.
And more and more. It's not neighborhood kids doing it. They're too busy.
People can't get a job elsewhere.
There's something I wanted to mention about water quality, too. And it was interesting because then I came to Holden. I started thinking about the tailings piles, and I wanted to know, you know, well, what's going on with this, you know, with this water? And I learned really quickly talking to some people, you could actually go down below the tailings and take a drink of the water, and if it wasn't for the Giardia, you'd be fine, because that's the water that's the affluent actually passes safe drinking water standards. It's kind of interesting. But the problem is that the heavy metal concentration is high enough that it's messing up the macroinvertebrates, or the little critters that the fish eat. So it's a lot of the need for the remediation is due to the impacts on the aquatic resources. But it is important. I mean, some places I've been in Colorado, it's not that simple. There's really a lot of places where wells or rivers were pretty damaged over there, and I'm sure further east. I mean, I grew up in Missouri, and there's just a lot of stuff that gets loaded into the water. The quality, water quality issues there are pretty important. For the rest of the week, I just kind of wanted to introduce things today and kind of keep it a little bit light, because I just wanted to keep it open. And the rest of the week, I'm going to be talking more about Western water law, how that works, provide some detail on that, and then talk about some of the programming that's happened that has to do with how people are working together in the West to share water resources and things like that. But I wanted to just take this opportunity to ask if there are specific issues, because I do have a lot of background in all of this, and I'm not sure what would be interesting or more or less interesting to you guys. So I just wanted to give you guys a chance to influence the content a little bit. Yeah.
Well, one is depletion of groundwater in areas where the water table is dropping, so they pump faster to use it up.
Yeah.
I'd be very interested in interstate cooperation around rivers. The Missouri runs through South Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there's a lot of disputes from, we are downstate from North Dakota, which is downstate from Montana, and who decides how that system of dams works. Of course, we had a cataclysm a year ago.
Yeah, my hometown's right here, Hamburg, Iowa, where it was an island there for a while, so.
But what about international? Doesn't the Colorado River run dry somewhere before some people need water?
Yeah. California's a little mud.
Yeah, it's set up that way. It's completely allocated.
Before it gets to Mexico?
There's a part that goes through Mexico and leaks out.
By law, we have to allow a certain amount of water to flow past the border.
Yeah. It's not very much.
That's all the week.
Okay.
How about flooding? It's a natural thing. And is it possible to build towns in a way that are not in the flood areas? Or is that just inevitable?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of flooding. I just keep thinking of these Missouri examples, you know. So Missouri floods, and you know, just stories of these people that want to rebuild down the floodplain, but then it's just like they were working, basing their information on it having not been a problem in years past, and then things changed just with how the Army Corps managed the lakes up above and the barge traffic, and you know, there's a lot of considerations that go into that Missouri Mississippi system. I wish my dad were here. He's like a total expert on that. But, yeah.
I'm interested in agricultural changes in eastern South Dakota. I grew up on a farm where we never took water for granted, ever, ever, ever. I mean, ever. It was always very, very precious. But we grazed a lot of cattle. We raised row crops, and then we had pastures. And I was out visiting our farmland, and it's you know, fence-to-fence corn now, or soybeans, which take a lot more water than grazing cattle on grass, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, what are the changes in the, there's a much higher need for water and for fertilizer, and the groundwater is affected, I imagine, by all of these changes, and there's just no, anything that was a wetland is being farmed now, because corn is so expensive, corn is so high priced, and people can make a lot of money off of it.
And then we get into the floods.
Yeah. Well, and that's the other thing. In northeast South Dakota, there are counties that are underwater that never used to be underwater. 20 years ago, they flooded, and then the floodwaters never receded. It's, the geography has changed. The shale has changed. Something's changed in your area where you grew up, Paul. It's, I mean, hundreds of acres that was farmed for generations can't be farmed anymore. So what happens to those families?
Because of the flooding.
Yeah, and it's,
yeah.
It's permanent flooding, right? In the county.
Did you have something over here?
Yeah, there must, you were saying how water's not, some part about not being, you didn't want to be political about water, but water is about politics and what about policy. How has that changed throughout the years, and what influences it? How can we make good policy?
Well, I think one of the things, and I'm going to talk about this tomorrow, I like to divorce these natural resource issues from symbolic political fights.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, in my community, this whole groundwater debate, you got people on the one side that are part of the real estate industry that collapsed, and they're looking at somebody to point a finger at because they got egg on their face, you know, and all these people are out of business. Or you've got politicians, and when I say, look at these bad government people, and give me votes, you know, they name an enemy, like the government's trying to ruin our lives. And you got this conservation groups on the other side that just want to stop all development and growth, and want to say, look at these bad people messing up our water supplies, et cetera, et cetera. And they use the water to stop the growth. You know, and by the way, we're fighting the bad guys, so give us $35 checks. Well, none of these people actually really care about the water. We're not having a discussion about water. We have people on the one side that are working for their egos or their votes, and the other side that are working to stop growth and get membership. But nobody's talking about water. Water is not being valued in that. People's personal agendas. So when I talk about divorcing politics, yes, it's a very political issue. But I think it's important to talk about the right issues and not impose other agendas into water. So,
in the discussion you have, can you give us a little background on the role of the Army Corps of Engineers in this and your assessment of how that's going?
I can give you a little bit of background, though it might be a community discussion. I know a little bit about it, and especially the Bureau of Reclamation as well. Army Corps did a lot of this big stuff, the Upper Missouri, and then the Bureau did a lot more of these big irrigation projects out here. Did you have something over there? I saw another hand.
I would like you to continue the discussion we had about fluoride.
Oh, to talk about some of these water quality issues. And there's really interesting things to talk about with respect to pollution and ideas about toxics. People get really worried about toxics, and I do have some experience with that. There's the things I'm afraid of chemically that aren't what other people are afraid of, and so, okay, I'll put that down anyway.
I still don't understand, if you can't buy and sell water, how is it we buy and sell bottles of water? What are we buying, a container?
Name of the container.
So there, somebody owns the right to consume, it's a good point. But
companies in New England have bought out water rights in order to bottle the water.
Yeah.
I saw a recent movie on that.
Bottled water is, I will talk about bottled water.
Yeah.
It's funny.
Turn on the tap, put a fancy label on it, sell it for.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you think about, I buy water for sometimes $100 an acre foot, which is like 325,000 gallons. So, you know, sometimes it costs more than that, but I'm sitting here like, well, I got 325,000 gallons of water, you know, in perpetuity every year for $100, so I'm not going to buy this bottle of water.
It costs about $8.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
A gallon.
Some of the things we've talked about, it's interesting, you know, the tailing things here, the water cleaning up because of the heavy metals causing the microscopic life not to exist in, you know, in the waterway. But we have the opposite problem back where we're at, where we get too many nutrients and we have too much stuff. And all of this, no matter what part of this whole thing you talked about, it all comes back to balance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, know, how do you balance all of this?
I would.
And one thing I'd like to hear you talk about or teach us is what can we do on our little area or, you know, our little lives to preserve and to protect, you know, the resource.
Excellent. Yeah, and I know for a fact that Ron's going to be talking a little bit about some of this, right? And Ben tomorrow's going to have a session on it as well, whereas there's some of these interesting discussions about ecological significance of water, and especially in spiritual questions, and also land use. I think you're going to be talking a little bit more about how some of the land use and those decisions is impacted. I always like to say, what can you do? And I hate those 50 simple things kinds of things, because I don't think I've seen a single one of those that actually gives people the things to do to make a difference, but, you know, it's a good idea.
Yeah. Given the relationship among the sessions this week, I think it's a good chance, too, to talk about what we mean by these things, like spiritual, economic, political. I'd be interested to hear from you, because I'm not convinced that an economic view of water necessarily gets us closer to a spiritual view of water. Mm-hmm. One of the things I would say that's spiritual about water is that everybody needs it and it's all about sharing it, which is of course highly political. And so to just be, I think we've got a great chance this week to think about those words and what we mean by that.
I think that's a really good thing to talk about. Is that question of, do you share it, do you privatize it? We're dealing with that with so many issues anyway. It's a good discussion.
And nobody has said the word ethical, but mm-hmm. but certainly those are ethical questions.
Yeah. I think inviting some debate about some of these things is really setting up. You know, I would encourage everybody to have a healthy debate and, you know, challenge me on things too that I present with respect to water. But, you know, I think that there's a lot of things we're still working out with that. So, okay, I know it's it's a little after four. So,
okay.
Thank you.